én kofferidem, és ne zsáj. Mert én számom stámi, majd tiszte dolgok, hogy nékene. Tom, de aldi szóra állt a pattőre, rakhane. Én ezt perintem, pan frem, pan frem, meg is. Patrón, de aldi zagléra, zagléra, madonna, en osva.
Riz.
Ebi palné, mlát, mlát, én tot is sziú. Sziú, ne tá němské občany, ten černý batom. Pravo, tisté pravo, volk. Krásný.
Radijské zgodbe o lidech, ki ustvarjajo duch časa. Na Radiu Študent.
Lepo pozdravljeni. V drugem delu Zeitgeista o kritični in kontra kartografiji, ki je sicer v etru Radija Študent teden dni kasneje, kot je bilo napovedano. Ker bo današnja oddaja nekoliko drugačna od ustaljenih, vam na začetku podajamo nekaj navodil, ki bodo služila kot kompas za natančnejše umeščanje vsebine v širši kontekst. Oddaja je sestavljena iz dveh medijev, radijskega etra in medmrežja. Internet v tem primeru deluje predvsem kot razširitev, medtem ko vsebina v etru prosto plava in išče natančnejšo umeščenost. S sprotnim poslušanjem in spremljanjem spletne strani pod rubriko Zeitgeist bo tako manko koordinat znotraj zvočne vsebine dopolnjen z množico njih v presežnem internetu. Vsaka izjava v zvočnem delu oddaje, razen uvodne, bo jasno ločena od ostalih, pri čemer služi krajša, ki napoveduje daljšo, kot povezovalna točka med zvočno in spletno vsebino. Vendar tako ena kot druga lahko delujeta tudi sami zase.
The history of panoptic mapping is very much bound up with the history of colonialism and the whole kind of history of cartography as an instrument of power and domination, really, isn't it? So, you know, a lot of work, like deconstructing the kind of official cartographies, we don't really have to do that work in a sense it's already been done. But I think what then needs to follow on from that is another way of doing mapping, which is quite different from the sort of processes which governmental map making involves, and you know that's taking place in a lot of different contexts. For example, there's a whole movement of indigenous cartography in places like Latin America and Africa, where ethnographers, for example, are actually working with groups whose lands are kind of threatened by corporations, and sometimes by the government. To enable them to kind of restake their territorial claims in ways that will kind of be rhetorically convincing. So they're not simply teaching people how to use GIS or Google Maps. They're actually working off the existing cultural practices of those groups and finding ways of kind of formulating and formalizing some of that in the form of maps. I think, you know, it's clearly a challenge to the whole kind of tradition of cartography, which is all about sort of defining borders and boundaries and staking claims to property and so forth. So I think it's very important to have a sort of counter movement to all that.
Hegemonic kind of structure of abstraction. Contradiction comes through very clearly with an example like Google Maps. I mean, Google Maps is something that, I mean, everyone kind of uses to some sort of extent, and it's very practical. You can use it to kind of create your own itineraries. You can kind of map your own kind of life in your own kind of way of your own journeys, your own kind of culture, if you like. But at the same time, it's part of this process of abstraction, whereby all these mapping technologies that we're increasingly able to kind of hook into and use as part of our everyday life are part of this kind of big kind of global corporate kind of hegemonic kind of structure of abstraction. So there is a kind of contradiction there in terms of just the everyday engagements with kind of mapping technologies. So I guess part of my initial interest in that was just kind of playing on that contradiction and kind of seeing, you know, how people are, through their own kind of forms of mapping practice, they're kind of maybe combating that in some way or creating other kind of networks, other practices that kind of address and kind of work against this kind of spatial logic that Google kind of exemplifies, in that, you know, ultimately it scales up to this kind of view from space looking down. It's that kind of totalizing, kind of all-encompassing kind of spatial logic that comes with Google. Political with a small p, I would say. Paris Maps are a really interesting example. I mean, there's something slightly, very kind of parochial about it on the one hand. I think it's the term Paris. It evokes a kind of old village type feeling of, you know, the church and the Paris and that kind of almost oldie-worldy kind of feel to it. But the idea of Paris Maps just came out on precisely the kind of things that we've been talking about, a sense that how people might experience space or their own kind of environment it becomes increasingly alienated from how they might wish to see it or how they do see it. So that was an initiative that came up through this organisation called Common Ground. I think this is going back to the 80s now. And it was, you know, at its simplest, it was just, you know, inviting community responses for people to kind of reimagine or represent in some shape or form what for them was a kind of authentic or accurate depiction of a spatial kind of experience of their lives, you know, a map that relates to them personally, but also was part of more of a collective community kind of sense of place. So it was a really political with a small p, I would say. It was an attempt to kind of cohere a sense of community engagement around place and landscape to try and offset or counter, you know, some of these kind of abstract understandings of space that, you know, certain environments, certain locations fall prey to. We kind of hand over so much of our own kind of agency and autonomy to these big kind of overarching structures, navigation systems. The more we get tuned into and climatized to these technologies, these geospatial mapping technologies, you know, and they do have very obvious practical benefits. I mean, you know, the sat nav is kind of a useful thing to have, but at the same time, the more and more these kind of automated kind of navigation tools just become part and parcel of what we're attuned to. You know, the kind of end game logic of that is kind of quite scary, I think, because we kind of hand over so much of our own kind of agency and autonomy to these big kind of overarching structures, navigation systems that, you know, on an everyday level can be quite useful and very practical. But ultimately, they're part of these kind of very global hegemonic spatial systems that we increasingly get kind of sucked into and absorb, probably without thinking about it. So I think that the extent to which there's a certain automatism that we kind of hand over willingly to organizations like Google or whoever it is, as a kind of trade-off for having something that's very practical and very useful, you know, in that process, what you lose along the way, I think, is a kind of a sense of a spatial experience that's otherwise very kind of grounded in the body, very grounded in your own kind of very embedded experience in negotiating everyday spaces. That's kind of lost, and I think that what is at danger of being lost through that is a kind of sense of engaging with the world where, you know, there's a kind of more autonomy, more kind of authentic sense of your own kind of engagement and spatial interaction with the world. Technology in very, very different ways, in very, very interesting ways. I don't think it's necessarily a case of, you know, expressing kind of criticism or concern about technology per se. I think the fears around kind of, you know, the kind of mindless autonomism that might come through in kind of your ceding or surrendering certain parts of your kind of spatial praxis, your everyday kind of spatial engagement to navigation technologies, that's one thing. But on the other, which is I think what you're alluding to, there are kind of very interesting kind of experiments, initiatives, ideas that artists and others are working with, where they're using technology in very, very different ways, in very, very interesting ways. And I think this also comes back to a sense of trying to create new and provoke new kind of forms of engagement through these technologies. So I think things like, you know, I've not actually heard this, I'd like to find out more about this, but actually physically implants in the body that can kind of attune yourself to your environment in different ways. And that feeds into kind of a new or heightened sense of spatial experience. This is kind of really, really interesting. So, you know, technology can be used in kind of very interesting ways to kind of, you know, undo or reverse or challenge in some way the kind of the dominant spatial experiences that otherwise that kind of come off the back of just our everyday kind of surrendering to, you know, these kind of abstract spatial navigation kind of systems that we would otherwise, you know, fall prey to.
Thank you.
wiggly mental maps. One of the recent bits of work we did was with a group of young people in a new school in East London, a school that's only been there for a year. And the long-term project we're doing with them is to try and get them to produce a young person's map and guide to the Olympic Park. But in starting the project off, we realised we didn't know these kids and we wanted to find out a little bit more about them and how they saw their own place in the school. So we asked them to start discussing and drawing sketch maps of where they lived and how they came to school. Some of them live very near the school and others live 10 or 15 miles away, 20 miles away, and come by car or bus or a combination of public transport. And what we found is that the maps they produced out of their heads were very interesting because they created a space, a sort of linear, wiggly space that these young people experienced twice a day in going from a home territory, which they knew, through maybe transport networks, roads, bus journeys, or walks, through areas that they didn't really know, to another area in the school which they were coming to make their own. And these wiggly mental maps that they drew started to get annotated by little diagrams of where West Ham Football Ground was or where the river was in relation to the spaces they knew. And sometimes they had to work together in twos and threes to actually figure out what they did pass through in going from home to school. So it was an exploring and creating process for them, and it was a very interesting process for us to see pathway mapping, creating a map of a journey, emerging spontaneously from groups of people without needing any special techniques or technologies. So that was an example for us of mental maps, which started out as individual representations and then became the subject for group discussions and eventually collective model making using the large text, cut out bits of paper and drawings and writing to start to build up a shared map of the spaces that they all knew and experienced through their home and school life. And that process was an emergent one. It didn't depend on starting with a base map. It was a process that came out of beginnings and endpoints and intermediate experiences. And that was a mental mapping exercise, both sort of conceptually and visually. And I think that process underlined for us how important it is to build maps out from purpose and experience rather than starting with a global ground plan like Google Earth and positioning everything in the same space. Mapping impossible places. This is something that's becoming very apparent, that counter-mapping, mapping, creative mapping, mapping impossible places, artist maps, they are very important. The first reason they're important is that they challenge the idea that ultimately there's only one map and it's the map of the world. I'm not just talking about Google. I mean the whole idea of everyone agreeing what the place is, the world, and then subdividing it into countries or states or political territories, the East and West, Left Bank, South Bank. This is a very suspect activity, and we the more we see of artist maps, the more we realise that they at least suggest the possibility that maps don't have to be top-down, uniform, consensus or imposed spaces. They can be spaces that grow out of purposes and imagination. So the use of counter-mapping and creative mapping is important politically and culturally. It enables people to think
that they can create and build maps and use maps in different ways, and that they don't have to just receive a position. They don't have to locate themselves in a space that someone else has defined. And I think politically that's the single most important thing about creative and counter-mapping processes.
Mapping, in whatever form, kind of generates stories and narratives. So just something as very simple as doing a kind of hand-drawn memory map. I was involved in a project looking at popular music and popular music heritage, and as part of that, we just kind of invited people to do a map of their own kind of music memories, you know, how popular music was kind of meaningful for them in terms of their life stories and certain memories they had. And we left it quite open. We just said, think of a map in whatever way, you want to do it. And we had a variety of different things, different kind of maps, some conventional geographical maps, others. This guy had a lot of tickets that he'd collected for the various concerts he'd been to, and he'd arranged them in such a way that kind of told a narrative about, who and where he was at a particular time in his life. Looking at films fundamentally from their, what they can tell us about the environment and the spaces that were inhabited at that time. That came out of a research project I was involved in a few years ago, looking at how archive film of a city, and it was the city of Liverpool, how that might kind of feed into understandings of space, historical space and the landscape and things like that. So it was a project where we were looking at lots and lots, a couple of thousand archive films, amateur films, newsreels, documentaries, a whole array of different material, creating a kind of database where the focus was on the spatial information that we could extract from these films. So, what buildings, what locations are shown in the films, what kind of spatial practices might there be in the film. So if it's a film shot on a busy street in 1910, it's an everyday scene, so an everyday life scene and things like that. So looking at films fundamentally from their, what they can tell us about the environment and the spaces that were inhabited at that time. And as I say, we created all that information, all that data into a big database. And then that was converted to a GIS model, an interactive map. This is where all the kind of the early stuff on maps kind of came out of, was this research on film. So more recently, I've revisited this. There's a couple of articles, one in a book called Marxism and Urban Culture, which I think might be the one you're referring to. It's kind of thinking as archival film practice, as part of a broader kind of politics, a critical kind of spatial practice, I guess, is how I'm coming at this. And in that particular article, I gave two examples. I talk about Liverpool and how through the work that we did on kind of Liverpool's spatial history and film, essentially, a kind of cinematic geography of Liverpool, how that can kind of feed into kind of contemporary understandings of space and place in the city, and how that can challenge and provoke, certain assumptions or certain understandings that govern how the space is thought about and discussed today. So it had a kind of political import in that sense. It created a kind of discourse of space and time. So I drew on that particular example. Question about what a map is, I think, is interesting insofar as it does open up that question of what it can do. The question about what a map is, I think, is interesting insofar as it does open up that question of what it can do, because ultimately, for me, that's the most important thing, what it's tied to in terms of its performative affect, you know, what the map does. And partly it's a way also of challenging kind of conventional understandings, traditional cartographic understandings of what maps are. And I think that's something that needs to be kind of contested, is kind of reclaiming what mapping and map making might be from this kind of orthodox cartographic disciplinary discourse.
Zeitgeist sta pripravila Anuša in Gregor. Za tehniko je skrbel Linč, brala sem Valentina.
In ko pridem jaz nazaj, pa te samo ostane, imam tiste dolge hodnike, ne. Tam dolje so vrata, pa tre vrata, ne. In jaz pridem tam, pa prema vrata, pa ne vidiš. Pa tam dolje zagledam Madonna eno šo.
Res.
Je bil pa lep. Mlad in to je siv, ne ta nemški očajnik, ne, črn pa to ne, prav tista prava volk, ne, krasen.
Radijske zgodbe o ljudih, ki ustvarjajo duh časa, na Radiju Študent.